Next is regulations. Department of Education regulations that are for action or discussion. Regulation 902 is gifted or talented education plan. It is for action. Kathy Kelly, the Director of Curriculum, Instruction, and Professional Development, and Lauren Conrad, the Education Associate for Visual and Performing Arts, are here for questions on Regulation 902 that was introduced last month. Are there any further updates regarding this regulation?
Good evening.
Hey.
Pursuant to Delaware Code, the Department of Education seeks the consent of the State Board of Education to continue the amendment to Regulation 902, Gifted or Talented Education Plan. This regulation was proposed in October 2023 to clarify language in order to continue to allow gifted and talented services to be provided based on a school district's or charter school's capacity and to outline school district and charter school responsibilities. In November 23, it was determined that additional clarification was needed to explain that both school districts and charter schools must have a gifted and talented education plan, with school districts and charter schools determining the extent of the plan and the areas of giftedness covered. Notice of the proposed regulation was published in the Delaware Register of Regulations on December 1st, and we at the department received two written comments concerning the proposed amendments. The first regarded the definition of capacity that stated that no database criteria for assessing what services a school or district provides was mentioned. And we believe that when LEAs submit their plans for approval, the method and norm reference tool for identification is part of that process by which their plans are reviewed. And then the second issue that was brought to our attention was if the lack of reference for district or charter schools plan is problematic, as differences in the school districts or charter schools interpretation of capacity to provide services could result in inequities between different districts and between different charter schools. And part of the review process is working with LEAs to provide feedback, support, and guidance on how to explore ways to provide gifted services when resources may be limited in an effort to ensure students' needs are met. As part of the onboarding for charters in the coming months, the department, in collaboration with the Statewide Advisory Council for Programs for Gifted and Talented, will host professional development during the summer of 2024, which will be open to all districts and charters to learn more about gifted plans, how to support identification, and tools to support the needs of gifted learners. Are there any questions?
Are there any questions or comments from board members?
So we're very excited about the opportunities of this regulation to allow for this to be a non-question about whether or not it's accessible and available for all students. That's great. My question centers around onboarding for those districts or charters that don't have, you know, a program. What does the implementation timeline look like in terms of like when they're required to get this up and running based on the regulation?
Certainly. So presently, as the regulation dictated prior, all of the traditional districts across the state have a gifted plan. Our charter schools are going to be onboarded over the course of the next 2 years. So between now and the end of this school year, we are updating our guidebook to support implementing and getting charters involved. Then the charter schools and the district, as I mentioned, will be involved or have the opportunity to be involved in the summer for professional development to learn how to build their guidebook and their plans to support their gifted learners. And then they have a year from September 24 to complete their plan. So they get a full year's time to build their team and to create their plan.
Awesome. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Yes. Can you elaborate a little bit more for my edification around the capacity word that seems to be problematic that they indicated? Can you talk a little
Certainly.
Bit about that? Because it looks like that's a common theme or motif between both public responses.
Capacity, really, in this instance, is talking about each district and charter's capability to meet the plan and to decide how they're going to execute their plan based on the definition of a gifted learner. There are six domains to giftedness. However, we recognize that each district may or may not have full capacity to identify based on all six domains of giftedness. So this word capacity provides them the opportunity to have and recognize a little bit more flexibility in that.
So does this create some inequitable systems within different charters or schools? I guess, because I think that's the concern that they don't have the capacity, if I'm understanding correctly, to implement the regulation.
The regulation is simply talking about creating the plan. So everyone creates the plan, but they still get the opportunity to decide what that plan looks like based on the parameters that are within the guidebook. So with our support and with the support of the Statewide Advisory Council, we are working to ensure that students' needs are met within the regulation.
Can I take a crack at that one?
You may.
I think it's safe to say, correct me if I'm wrong, Lauren, that in the coming years, as the Statewide Council supports charter schools in particular, but also districts, that with various models from the outside looking in, one could assume that perhaps there are inequities in terms of services, right? So take a district like Brandywine, who has had a full-time gifted program, not push in and pull out, which has its pros and cons. Mm-hmm. And you look at that model that's been in existence for a long period of time, and you compare that to a school that is just dipping its toe in the water with a push-in gifted program. I think over time, those perceived inequities will flatten some. But I think as, the regulation takes hold initially, there will be, some sharing of best practices through the council and maybe even some site visits between schools and districts. But again, to be clear, having been directly involved in a full-time program, which many people would say that's what every district should have. Careful of what you wish for, because there are pros and cons to all of that, right? And so supporting the charter schools and the LEAs to make localized decisions that best support within the framework of the, the six domains, to me, that makes sense. And I have to ask a question out of curiosity. Do districts and schools still use the Naglieri as an assessment for identification or not? Some?
Yeah.
Yeah. I just remember being on the receiving end of many phone calls.
How they identify as part of their plan.
Yeah. Most families believe their children are indeed gifted.
Right? 1,000%.
If there are no further questions or comments from the board members, is there a motion to approve Regulation 902 as presented?
Wally Rushdan, so moved.
Rushdan's made a motion. I need a second.
Reverend Powell, second.
Reverend Powell, second. Any discussion? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
One clarification. We're not allowed to vote tonight, not correct?
That's
correct.
Want to make sure.
Okay, next on the agenda, Dale Matusevich, the Director of Sectional Children Resources, is here to present information on three regulations. Dale?
Great. Thank you and good evening. So we are bringing before you for your information, and I will apologize up front. We had a miscommunication in our office. We were going to give a few slides to you. Because there's like 98 pages within these three regulations. So I will make sure I get that to Mrs. Smith to be able to get out to the board so you know specifically where the major changes or proposed revisions are at. But I will briefly talk through those tonight as well. So pursuant to Delaware Code, the Secretary of Education is seeking the consent of the State Board to amend Title 14, Delaware Code 922, 923, and 925, around children with disabilities, subpart A, for the purposes and definitions. Also looking at the general duties and eligibility of agencies and the evaluations, eligibility determination, individualized education programs. So this these regulations are being amended to add definitions to help clarify changes made to Title 14, Delaware Code 922 or 923, Children with Disabilities, subpart general duties and eligibility of agencies, as well as 925, as just mentioned, Children with Disabilities, subpart D, evaluations, eligibility determination, individualized education programs. Other grammatical changes were made to comply with the Delaware Administrative Code, drafting and style manual. And we, our hope is that these regulations will be approved and go into effect July 1, 2024. We do have two public hearings. We had one yesterday. They are available in person or virtually. The one we held yesterday on Wednesday, January the 17th at 5 p.m. We had a host location here in the cabinet room, as well as the virtual option. Our second public meeting will be on Monday, February the 19th at 12 o'clock. The host location again will be here in the cabinet room with the virtual option as well. So as we are looking at those regulations, as you know, in the round of changes to Regulation 925 around evaluations, eligibility determination, and individual education programs that were published in July of 2021, we focused mainly on the eligibility and related definitions, kind of the front part of that 925 regulation. So we've come back to revise 925 in its entirety and correct some minor omissions in the eligibility sections. And these changes to 925 have led to the changes to definitions found in 922, as well as changes to one section in 923. So just a kind of a rough timeline of how those things have kind of come to fruition. So between December of 2021 and April of 2022, we met with stakeholders to review and revise Regulation 925 that was also leading to changes in 922 and 923. We had approximately 15 people were assembled representing Delaware's three counties, including special ed directors, parent advocates, and additional constituents. From examples being the Governor's Advisory Council for Exceptional Citizens, as well as Autism Delaware. That stakeholder group met six times over that period. From April of 2022 until the present time, the Exceptional Children Work Group has reviewed the recommended changes and shared with legal counsel and sought follow-up with stakeholders as needed to the proposed revisions that are out for public comment period. Our public comment period for IDEA regulations and special ed regulations has to run for 60 days. So that public comment period began on January 1st. It will close on March 1st, and that will be for all three regulations. During from March 1st to May 1st, the Exceptional Children Resources Work Group will then review and consider the input from that public comment. So we're hoping that these that the published revisions for this round will be in effect and approved by the board, so we can put those in effect for July 1, 2024. And again, this will be dependent on the nature of the comments that we receive during the public comment period and whether substantive changes will be warranted, prompting a second round of public comment. So just kind of the quick highlights here for 922 in section 3, there was a revision made to denote three definitions were added. These were the terms appearing in 925 and or 923, and they include homebound or hospital placement, the individualized family service plan, and print disability. Moving to 923, we are looking at section 16 around placements. And we are proposing to include a new section 16.6. So the only change within this again is that section 16 around placements and the addition of 16.6. And we're hoping that this section provides clarification for IEP teams for circumstances under which a child with a disability is in danger of to himself or herself, or so disruptive that the behavior substantially interferes with the learning environment of others in the class. The substantial revisions are in 925. So we have a number of sections here that we are proposing revisions to, other than just other grammatical things that we needed to clean up and renumbering from the previous round. So we're looking at section 925.5, that is additional requirements for evaluations and reevaluations. Section 6 around the determination of eligibility. Section 7, individualized education program. Section 8, the IEP team. Section 10, when IEP shall be in effect. Section 11, the development, review, and revision of the IEP. Section 13, educational placements in their least restrictive environment. And section 15, high school graduation. So as 925 was reviewed thoroughly by stakeholders and the Department of Education and legal counsel, revisions were made to these sections that when you receive the slides, these sections will be noted in black text. So the focus for this round of revisions, again, was on the sections that were previously just mentioned. And the eligibility, the front part of 925 was substantially revised in 2021. So that's where we're at currently. And I will make sure that I get these slides to make it easier for you to sift through the proposed revisions to the regulations. And I'll get those to Ms. Smith tomorrow.
All right, thank you. Are there any questions or comments from the board members?
I just have one question. Dale, I noticed specifically just looking now at 925, some of the print was italicized. I know when you had changes, it was underlined or additions, but is there anything to be noted about what's italicized versus non-italicized?
Yes. So the regular font, the non-italicized, is almost verbatim out of our federal IDEA regulations. The italicized is kind of unique to Delaware and kind of goes above and beyond what is in IDEA. So those are very specific to Delaware. I guess we kind of Delawareized them, if that's a word. yeah, well, I am from the South originally, so we can, I think I have a little leeway to make up for it. But it's the anything that you see in our regulations that's italicized, it's kind of the Delaware version, and that's gone above and beyond what the federal regulations are saying that we have to do.
Great, thanks.
You're welcome.
So I have a very high level question. When you were explaining about some of the revisions in 925, you mentioned a lot of words that were, you know, we talked about the actual IEP, the IEP team, the least restrictive environment, all these sort of buzzwords that are fundamental and key. And when you frame the conversation, I remember it being sort of around sort of definitional sort of improvements, you know, to clarify the tweaks that speak to these particular terms. Are these just definitional improvements, or are they more substantive tweaks to how they look and operate?
Yeah, so good question. So basically all of our, and I will look to Mr. Corbin down there to help me explain if I'm not explaining it clearly. So for us, our 922 section is all of our definitions of where we really define things out. When you get more into that 925 section, that's really substantive changes that we're making to kind of processes and the development of different pieces, say within the IEP, requiring or looking at what the required IEP team members or who can be IEP team members. So it's, there's the definitions are in 922. It's just some of the things that we were looking at revising in 925 caused us to need to make additional or create those three additional definitions that we're putting in 922. But the 925 is going to be more of the kind of meat and potatoes, if you will.
Sure. So probably where a comment, if any, will
be yes.
generated.
Yes.
Thank you. Are there any further questions?
When will we see this, these regulations to actually vote for action?
The next board meeting, I believe, is the process.
Comments for 60 days, so it'll be at the March meeting.
Yeah. So we will look at, and let me ask a clarifying question too, because this is kind of the first time I'm really into substantive changes here as the director. We would need to make sure that we can sift through all of those comments, and the comment period doesn't end until March 1st. So it may be the April or possibly even the May board meeting. Because we would need time to digest and look at and consult within the department on either accepting the comments and making other revisions that could then, if it's substantive changes to our current proposed regulations or revisions, then we would have to go back out for public comment again, which would take an additional 60 days of public comment. So it, the timeline could move out even further.
The reason why I ask in terms of my edification to really understand, there's a lot that you presented tonight. You indicated we are forthcoming some other information to simplify it. And so I just want to make sure I have enough data so I can research it and yep. make an informed decision.
Yeah, I would, my best, I mean, we would probably be pushing, and I'm going to look for to Mr. Corbin. We would, with the window closing for public comment March 1st, my experience in going through these processes before, we would not be likely to, I mean, it would probably be stretching it even to make the April meeting, I'm thinking.
It all depends on how much comment is.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. If there are no further questions or comments, appreciate your presentation, and we'll see you in the future. Thank you. Have a good evening.
Good evening.
Next, Professional Standards Board regulations for discussion or action. Dr. Linnea Bradshaw, Executive Director of the Professional Standards Board, will review two regulations for action and introduce two regulations for information. Dr. Bradshaw, welcome.
Thank you, and welcome to the two new board members. You may not know, but I am here every month, so I will see you often. Our first regulation is Regulation 1504. The Professional Standards Board seeks the concurrence of the State Board to for final publication for Regulation 1504, Certificate of Eligibility. It was published on December 1st. The PSB received two comments. The first comment was from Benjamin Schrader, Chairperson of the State Council of Persons with Disabilities. And the second comment from Ann Fisher, Chairperson of the Governor's Advisory Council for Exceptional Citizens, both of which were supportive of the proposed amendments explicitly. And the amendments were simply to clarify, 1504 is for emergencies, if you will, for teachers of students with disabilities, and therefore largely governed by federal law. And worked with Dale on this one as well. And so the Professional Standards Board voted at its February 11th meeting to forward this to the State Board for action. Are there any questions?
What day did you vote?
What day did we vote?
Yeah. Like you said, vote.
I think it was the 11th of January. Oh, did I say February? January 11th. I'm sorry. Yes.
What month we were in.
Sorry.
Okay. Well, thank you. Are there any questions or comments from the board members? If not, I entertain a motion to approve Regulation 1504 as presented.
So moved, Stevens.
Stevens has made a motion. I need a second.
Piper, second.
Piper, a second. Any discussion? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Oppose? Motion carries. All right, Dr. Bradshaw?
So likewise, on Regulation 1553, which is driver and traffic safety education teacher, this regulation was published on December 1st. If you recall, it only had one change in it. That was to specify that a person, an applicant, needed to submit a 5-year driving record and not any other type of driving record to the state. And so we received no comments.
No questions or comments from board members. Is there a motion to approve Regulation 1553 as presented?
So moved, Reverend Powell.
Reverend Powell's made a motion. I need a second.
Second, Stevens.
Oops, Stevens is second. Any discussion? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you.
So first, I would like to say that we have with us tonight, in case there are questions, because they are the experts, Tiffany Green and Dr. Michael Saylor from the Ed Excellence team regarding Regulation 1503, Comprehensive Educator Induction Program. This regulation was published on January 1. It was previously published on September 1, and I presented to the board during the month of December. During the month of September. And at that time, there was a question and a concern from the board about overlapping requirements, particularly for ARTC candidates. And so we did add some language regarding merging those requirements, particularly in subsections 4.3.3, 5.1.2, and 9.3.3. The comment period lasts until February 1st, and we already have 6 comments on the website. And so those comments will come to you next time, but feel free to go onto the DOE website and to look at any comments at any time. Are there any questions about this particular regulation?
I do have a couple of questions, okay. But I think probably more suitable for Tiffany than.
Oh, absolutely. That's why they're here.
In terms of content. I noticed in the public comments that have already been received, there was one comment coming from a Red Clay nurse who was questioning the flexibility of the program for nurses, since there's only generally one nurse in each building, that was there the flexibility for them to alter the program a bit to better serve their needs, where nurses maybe could meet at a higher level, I guess, bringing more of them together for the mentoring. I didn't know what would be the department's response on that.
Hi, Deb. Thanks for asking. I actually attended the last nurses meeting and I spoke with Sharon at the time, and I answered hopefully all of her questions. I'm sure you know you would be able to follow up with her if needed. Some of the information that that she had, as well as some of the other nurses, was incorrect. So I was glad I was able to attend their meeting and answer all of their questions. I also followed up that meeting with some other requested information that they asked for during the meeting, just so that I made sure that they were very clear. But to answer your question specifically, they were told that yes, currently right now during this year, all specialist programs are working on revising their programs just for that particular purpose, to make sure that there's flexibility in the program. One of the things, like you said, that Sharon was concerned about was the nurses being able to meet together. We are never going to discourage the nurses meeting together. I think one of the things that they were nervous about was not having someone who would bring all of them together at a certain point in time. That's not a concern. DOE is handling, overseeing that the nurse program continues, is flexible, and also includes the certification course that they do complete for one of our other ed associates here at DOE. So the good thing about the new specialist programs is that we are really working to make sure their national standards are included and that the programs are more specific to their programs and not just mimicking what the teachers are doing. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, that does. I do have another question. First of all, let me thank you for sending along the survey data that you sent along to Kathleen for review. I noticed in the survey data, there was one indication coming from the mentees regarding regular meetings with their coach. And there was indication that 23% met with their coach weekly, 59% met with their coach monthly. Does the 59% number include those meeting weekly, or is that adding two? So would I add 23 to the 59 to get a number that have been met?
Yes, that is correct. So one of the other things, as I tried to state previously about the meetings, the monthly meeting is a minimum. So we have found that a lot of the LEAs are actually going above that minimum and meeting more like two times a month instead, or biweekly, however you want to say it. And there are some that are actually still meeting weekly. It really does vary, but that is one of the things that we like about the flexibility of the program as well, is that it meets the needs of the LEA. It's not just DOE said do this, so this is what we're going to do, and we're only going to do the minimum. I've been very pleased with the LEAs that are currently implementing, that they are not just doing the minimum, they're actually doing way more. The other concern had been observations. And one of the things that we've noticed as well is that most, if not all, of the LEAs that are currently implementing are still doing their observations and going well above what they were doing previously.
Yeah, the survey results were very, very positive. I noticed that the percentages seemed to be quite high as far as people feeling that it was meeting their needs, both coming from the mentees as well as from the induction coaches. Would it be possible, I noticed with the series of questions in the appendix, to get the full survey results, because I'm assuming this is just like an overview of it. Would it be possible to get the full survey results? Because I'd also love to see that.
I'm sure that that's obviously possible. I would just reach out to NTC, who is conducting the survey for us, and see what's the best way for you to be able to access that.
Great. Thank you, Tiffany.
You're welcome.
Any further questions on 1503? Okay, Dr. Bradshaw, 1510.
So 1510 initial license was also published on January 1st, and the amendments to this regulation clarify the requirements for using the 91 days in lieu of student teaching. You may know through House Bill 315 in 2022, I believe it was, it expanded that 91-day pathway into the secondary course certifications. It has become probably one of the most popular pathways into teaching, and we realized very quickly, we attempted on our first draft of 1510 last year to address some of those changes, but it wasn't clear enough, and there weren't enough guardrails around the 91-day pathway, because it is an alternative. There is no higher ed involved, and it requires the district to sort of work as the ARTC program in a way. And so we didn't have any strict entrance requirements, and so we in this revision, it is a bachelor's degree and 24 credits in the content, or a bachelor's degree and pass the praxis, and or there are a few exceptions for a couple certifications. For the JDG program, there is an exception, and then there is also if a person has an Ed Studies degree, they can be accepted in that area where the Ed Studies degree is. So an Ed Studies degree is basically an education degree without student teaching. And so those people are often stuck if they want to go into public schools, because they don't have any way to get student teaching other than matriculating back into their college, paying all that money, doing the student teaching. The 91 days in lieu of is a way that they can accomplish student teaching while they are working as a substitute in a school. And so we clarified that pathway a little bit better with this regulation. Other amendments are to just conform it to the new 1503, because there were some things about the comprehensive educator induction program, because that is something that is an initial license requirement. And so with the new induction program, we had to amend 1510 as well. Are there any questions?
I know we have a shortage of teachers,
yes,
not only in Delaware, but by doing this, do you feel that we're going to meet the standards of not only recruiting, but upholding the standards?
So, and that's one of the reasons why we did the amendments, is because with the expansion to secondary core, which are some of our biggest shortage areas, secondary science, secondary math, secondary world language are like some of the areas where we have the hardest time getting teachers. And so what happened, districts didn't really know who to hire. And sometimes they would hire people as a long-term sub and want them to get into teaching. But if they didn't have a math background, there just isn't any chance of them actually passing the praxis to get finally certified. And so we're trying to create some guidelines to direct folks to a pathway that, or to finding people who may be more qualified, who can then actually have a smooth ride to their final certification, if that makes sense. And we're hoping there are about, I think there's about 50 people in the pipeline. This just started last year, and we've got a lot of people in the 91-day pathway right now. So for Delaware, that's a lot.
So just kind of building on the question here, it seems to me that there, with the guardrail terminology, there was some of the folks who may have come in who, you know, we don't want to certainly create regulations that are making it harder for people to come in, but it seems that some of these folks were in sort of limbo because they didn't have a viable way to kind of get to the end of without these guardrails. Like they're getting in, but they're not a clear pathway to kind of get to this ultimate goal of developing this person into a
yes.
X.
Yes. And so the second half of this is going to come to you in subsequent months. So we created these entrance guardrails to make sure that, yes, if you're going to be put in this pathway, you already have a bachelor's degree, because that's going to be required to get an initial license and an emergency cert. Yes, you need to have some sort of content background so that we know that you can pass the praxis, or you have to have already passed the praxis, so that we know that you'll have a smooth entry. We're also revising the requirements on the back end, because once a person goes through the 91 days, they do have to take 15 additional credits. And so we are requiring those 15 additional credits to be in education or content education now. And by allowing them to be in generic education or content education, that can also allow someone to matriculate into a program. The credits as they had stood originally were content education or content. And it just doesn't seem to me that you should just have to take 3 credits of content and 2 of pedagogy, and then, you know, voila, you're deemed as a teacher. And we had a lot of questions about what background you could use, whether those credits have to be after the bachelor's or not. And so this way, we're able to, if a person has education credits in their bachelor's degree, such as an ed studies person, they would have fulfilled some of those credits on the back end, if that makes sense as well. So we can, if a person comes in with both content and education credits, you know, we're able to allow them to move faster. If a person is coming in with just a content bachelor's, then they're very clear on the fact that they have to take education. And you can matriculate into a program, say Master's of Arts in Teaching, you could Master's in Curriculum Instruction, et cetera, very easily to be able to get those credits instead of taking one here and one here and trying to scrounge for some different particular credits. And making it clear that someone has to have a content background on the front end, because that was, we did have instances where people were hired without a content background to teach something with the hopes that they would be able to pass the Praxis at some point. And then to this, that just not happening, you know, time after time after time. And then, you know, unfortunately, we are in a teacher shortage. So, you know, are do we allow that person to continue? Do we, you know, we're in a really difficult situation there. And so we're trying to avoid those types of situations by kind of putting the content in the front.
Right. It's a balance.
It's a balance. Yeah. That, if that makes sense, it's a really confusing process. It took us, I think, a year to really hone this plan to where we think it's really, really will work.
Are there any further questions or comments, board members?
Great. Thank you, Dr. Bradshaw.
Good evening. Next on the agenda is Delaware Interscholastic Athletic Association regulations for discussion action. Dave Baylor, Executive Director of DIAA, is here to present information on Regulation 1040.
Good evening, everyone.
I think good evening.
This regulation has been previously discussed, and I think it's for its final consideration. Nothing has really changed from the last time we had the meeting and the presentation of the regulation.
Thank you. Are there any questions or comments for Mr. Baylor from the board members? All right, sir. Well, thank you. And we look forward to seeing you in the future.
Look forward to seeing you. You travel safely tomorrow if you're out there.
Thank you. Have a good evening.
You too, sir. Thank you.
Next is public comment on regulations. Time has been set aside at this point in the agenda for public comment on regulations. Ms. Smith, do we have anyone signed up for public comment on regulations?
No, we do not.
Thank you. We'll move to state board business. To center our work around our vision, our mission, our guiding principles, the state board has agreed to revisit these items at each meeting for those who may be attending. This information is available on our website and e-board site as well on screen at the moment. Committee and meeting reports. There is an opportunity for members to provide information and written reports made available on eBoard on any events or committee meetings attended since the last meeting. Would anybody like to share anything further? And before anybody gets started, I just want to give you a reminder. This is general housekeeping, why it's on my mind. Our next meeting is in the Colonial School District in February. So some of us will be traveling further and some of us won't.
I'm going to be at Wilbur Elementary School, which is a convenient location to access a relatively new school right off of Route 1. Before you, if you're heading north, it's before you get to the canal bridge. And if you're heading south, you got to come over. Well, I guess you don't have to. I think there might be another way. No, I guess you have to come over it. It's either that or go down to Delaware City. So I think you want to go to.
I don't think we'll do that. Or is it, would anybody like to share anything further?
Yeah, just to point out a couple of meetings on my report. I had the opportunity to listen into the joint meeting of the House and Senate Education Committees on January 11th for them to hear the recommendations of the Public Education Compensation Committee. And it was an interesting hearing. The department did, I think, an exceptional job of explaining the work that the committee had undertaken over, wow, it has been, what, about a year and a half, the work to produce the recommendations that they did. And it was encouraging. There didn't seem to be a lot of concern raised by senators and representatives. I think one of the major concerns was, would individual districts be able to meet the 30% requirement if they didn't necessarily have the tax base to do it. But beyond that, there seemed to be general support coming from the legislators for the recommendations that were put forward. So I thought it was a very, very good meeting. And again, to commend the department in doing a great job of explaining it, because understand it 70-30 at times. If you don't understand the schools being funded, it can be confusing for people. The other meeting to point out, Ms. Smith and I are representatives on the pre-K-3 Literacy Plan Review Committee. And so we had our first in-depth meeting to take a look at the goals set for strategic intent number one. The meeting led to some very good discussions. We were broken into three different groups, teachers, school leaders, and partners, to take a look at the goals set and what had been achieved by the department. And as you can see from my comments, there was a lot of praise for the number of materials created by the department to support early literacy. One comment coming though from the teacher group was that they still saw that more work needed to be done for materials coming in for the pre-K level, that a lot of the materials that were currently posted were more for grades 1, 2, and 3. So I'd like to see more in the pre-K area. Also, in identifying the numerous courses and micro-credentials that have been created for literacy, they'd like to see a little bit more data being collected to identify what groups are taking these courses and micro-credentials. And is there a better way of communicating these offerings so that they can boost participation? Because currently participation is low. So they weren't sure, you know, is it that a micro credential takes more time? Is that discouraging people? Or is it that people just aren't aware that these offerings are available? And if they found a way to communicate it better, that might boost participation. But for a 1 hour meeting, it was an extremely productive meeting, and we will be meeting again at the beginning of February to take another deep dive into those strategic intent number one goals. So that's my report.
Thank you. Deb, can I ask you a quick question?
Sure.
About the micro credentials.
Mm-hmm.
Are those, for that cohort of educators, are they pretty much free of charge, or are they at a cost?
If memory serves me, they are free of charge, because I think we still have a deal with the vendors. Because one of the things with micro-credentials, the work product that the educator submits has to be reviewed by somebody who has been deemed appropriate to do the review and approve the micro-credential. I know NEA in the past had supported the program out of their own buckets of money. And but they said eventually those assessors have to be paid. So I think somewhere down the road, you may see that there may be a charge for micro-credentials. Right now, people taking micro-credentials are getting paid at stipend. So it not only benefits them to improve their knowledge, but they also get a stipend for taking the micro-credentials. But it's more than a sit and get. It's a research, action-based research project that generally takes 15, 20 hours in order to complete. And it involves, you know, teachers coming up with a premise and then going in to try to prove that premise and see what works best so that they're developing best practices. And in this case, in the area of literacy.
Sounds like there's a story to tell.
Oh, there is. I mean, the ones I used to serve on PDAC, which was the group that framed the rubrics for the micro-credentials. And the development of the micro-credentials is an extensive process. And the educators that are taking the micro-credentials come back and say, this is by far the best professional development for me, more so than sitting in a 3 hour lecture type situation where you might have a test afterwards. They're actually implementing some of the strategies in the classrooms.
And one question about, they can mm-hmm. chunk it. So, you know, it's 15, 20 hours in some instances, but they can sort of do it at their pace, right?
They can do it at their pace. And two, if you put a number of them together, you get what's called a badge. So it's almost like another type of credential. And I think what you may see TDAC in future years coming down, we used to have programs where teachers could get additional money added to their salary. We used to call it the right-hand side of the salary schedule for taking a number of professional development offerings that were clustered. And that's what they were called, was clusters. Approved by the Professional Standards Board for additional compensation. And I think you may eventually see something like that down the pike for different badges in the micro-credentials area. Yeah.
Anybody else? Great. Well, thank you. Next is the Executive Director's Report. Ms. Smith will provide an update on her work to support board priorities since the last meeting. Ms. Smith.
Thank you. In between the holiday vacations and so forth, it was kind of a light month, but I'm thrilled to welcome the new members as well. It was an honor to be at their confirmation hearing yesterday. And I'm so glad you both are here. And also Vice President Stevens and I are going to visit the First State Military Academy in a couple of weeks. We made an appointment, if you will, with the principal. And so if any of you would like to join us, it'll be the afternoon of February 1st. It's a Thursday. So if you'd like to join us, we're going specifically to look at their project-based learning.
Any further questions for Ms. Smith? Thank you. Legislative update. During legislative session, we will have this item on our agenda to give board members an opportunity to ask questions or raise discussions about education related bills currently proposed in the legislature. Meredith Seitz, do you have anything for us?
Yes. Hi, everyone. Can you hear me okay?
Yes. Yeah. Good evening.
Good evening. I'm sorry for not being there in person and just wanted to say, you know, give a warm welcome to the new board members. Hopefully I can be in person with you next month. And so I'll be very brief, but the legislature reconvened last week. As a reminder, this is the second leg of the General Assembly, the current General Assembly, which means that they were kind of able to just jump right back into it. Any bills that were, you know, still active in the process, they were able to be taken up, you know, right where they were. So they did just that. So last week in the Senate, they passed two Senate bills sponsored by Senator Sturgeon related to aimed at, you know, teacher recruitment. The first one is SB 188, which would enter Delaware into the Interstate Teacher Mobility Compact. Once it's enacted by a sufficient number of states, it would allow teachers to kind of move more easily between states. It's kind of something aimed at those who may be like military spouses or in some sort of similar situation, enable them to get licensed quickly if they are in Delaware. The second one is SB 187, which would give salary credit towards graduate degrees earned before entering the teaching profession, even if those graduate degrees are not related to their specific content area. Again, both of those bills were passed by the Senate last week, and so they'll head over to the House. And I saw today that they're on the agenda for the House Education Committee next Wednesday. There's a few House bills that were heard this week, yesterday, in the House Education Committee. The first one is HB 263. That's having to do with student meal debt. You're probably all aware there have been some news articles a few months ago having to do with students who were not allowed to participate in certain extracurricular activities because of outstanding meal debt, and some advocates asking some questions about those policies. Those policies are determined at the local level, and this bill would basically prohibit that practice. And so that bill was released from the House Education Committee with pretty broad, even, you know, some bipartisan support. The next one is HB 252. This bill would give credit on the salary schedule towards teachers who have completed a year-long teacher residency. Right now, if they complete the year-long teacher residency, they still start at a salary step zero. This would start them at salary step one to again, give them credit, again, aimed at incentivizing more more people to take part in that program. That is a bill that the department has been collaborating with Representative Williams on. She's the sponsor. The last one that I'll mention is House Substitute 1 for HB 244. This is, bill was sponsored by Representative Mike Smith, and it would create a funding unit for athletic trainers for all high schools, all public high schools. The substitute bill, really the only difference is that it phases in the approach, so it's less of a hit to the budget each year. And that bill was also released from committee, but because of the fiscal impact, we'll have to go through the additional step of the House Appropriations Committee. So that's where it's been assigned. Kind of went through that fast. I'm happy to answer any questions, or, and obviously I didn't mention all the bills that are out there, just kind of a little sample of what's happened over the last couple of weeks. But again, happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Meredith?
Meredith, this is Wally. Around the last bill you mentioned with the separate funding unit for athletic directors or athletic trainers, rather, excuse me. Is it the current system where they're just considered sort of a teacher unit, sort of in that general pool that, you know, administrators have to make tough choices about whether or not to use it for this or that? And the idea is that we want to make sure athletics have a pathway to success.
So I'm sure the secretary can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think most schools, they already have these trainers. They don't receive any state funding for them. That is the difference. So they're all paid out of local funds. They're usually either contracted or, again, if they have a full-time position, that's just, it's just 100% funded on the local side. So this would create that 70% state share for these positions.
Thank you.
Anything else for Meredith? Well, thank you. And we look forward to hearing from you again next month on any updates, and have a good evening.
Thank you. You too.
Next on the agenda is the secretary's report. Secretary Holliday.
Sure. You have my my written report. I just wanted to highlight a couple of things that are outside of this report and one that's in it, and just elaborate a bit. And that is, today we're supposed to have the state of the state address by the governor. I have no doubt that education would have been his number one priority, and he would have spent some time talking about education. That will be rescheduled. I don't know if it'll be before or after the governor's budget release, but as Ms. Stevens shared, the PEC recommendations were submitted to the governor at the end of October. We actually got those to him a month early. And I am hopeful that, you know, sort of following suit with what this administration has done over the past 9 years, or pardon, nine, 7 years, pardon me. I'm hopeful that the governor's recommended budget will get at even more recruitment and retention in the education space, not just teachers, but, you know, the big difference, as I know I explained to the state board, minus the two new members, the difference between Delaware and what we are trying to do compared to, we keep hearing this, get to 60,000, which, you know, for a starting teacher salary. The PEC report does that. The recommendations within 4 years gets almost every district, and we believe by that point will get every district to a starting salary for teachers of 60,000. That's what Maryland recommended. And that was in part what drove Delaware and I think a number of other states that are really trying to, you know, make headway in the space of being more competitive with compensation for educators. The big difference is that this report addresses, we looked at every employee group within public education in Delaware. So we're talking about bus drivers, we're talking about paraprofessionals, we're talking about school nurses, we're talking about IP positions that aren't even in code right now. We made a recommendation around around that. We're talking about cafeteria staff, so food service, we're talking school nutrition. We're talking about, I think I mentioned bus drivers, school maintenance, custodians, and West Ed, who we contracted with and worked very closely with the department and a couple of chief financial officers to really look at regional competitiveness. What are districts in Maryland, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, who we compete with for teachers? What are they paying in these job categories? And that's not easy to ascertain, by the way. Teachers, administrators, relatively straightforward. Paraprofessionals, relatively easy. Good luck with bus drivers and school nutrition. It took a lot of work to compare because the way in which we compensate is different. Nonetheless, we did that, and we have made recommendations for all of those groups. And so I just wanted to highlight that, you know, in the coming couple of weeks here, I think there, there will be a lot of attention looking at, this administration's final year and what we're trying to do in the educational space. Then the other thing I just wanted to mention, the third bullet, on my written report here, we need as a state to do anything and everything we can to change the trajectory of our third grade smarter scores. We know that our state assessment scores, whether we were using DSTP 15, 20 years ago, whether we were using DCAS or now smarter, when our smarter scores, or I'll just say our state scores are up, our national report card score, NAEP scores are up. And when and the other drops, I was amazed. I didn't know this until I became secretary, that they run parallel to one another. And so you're aware, our scores over the past 10 years or so have been moving in the wrong direction. I think there are a lot of systems causes to that. With that said, at the end of the day, not many people care about those. They come across as excuses. And I think it's really important that we're not expecting to boil the ocean overnight here. What we need to do is change the direction. And it's a NAEP year. So our fourth and eighth graders will be taking NAEP. And so our team is working really hard with our 19 districts and charter schools, especially our elementary charter schools, to create a sense of positive urgency around being assessment ready. We don't want to make our students nervous, but we do want to make sure they are aware of how important these assessments are for the state of Delaware. And so the trajectory going down needs to start coming up. And I do think in the psyche of Delaware, in the education space and beyond, it would be really good for all, for families, yes, for advocates, for parents, especially for that trajectory as we are hopefully really beginning to emerge from this pandemic, to start seeing it change. It's easier said than done, but this is going to be our focus between now and the end of the school year. Anything and everything we can do to support all of our schools, elementary, middle, and high, but in particular, our third grade cohort this year. Because our thinking is, if we know that in third grade, if a student is proficient, the chances are they're gonna continue to be proficient. It's a lot easier than if not, right? And so we're really honing in on third grade. So I just wanted to share that with the state board. I know based on conversations I've had with some of you individually and collectively in meetings like this, I know you too are concerned about, our literacy performance. We have a great long-term plan. Our literacy, state literacy plan is a good one. We have legislation that has passed having to do with the science of reading that's really good. So I'm comfortable with what we're gonna be doing long-term. What I'm a little nervous about myself is that this upcoming spring, we have these assessments that I really think people are going to be looking at, understandably. They have been, but especially post-COVID, people are really paying attention. And they have their own sort of perspective on things, and they create their own narrative. So if we want to control the narrative, we need to change the trajectory. It's as simple as that. And that's what we're trying to do. Just wanted to share that with you.
Just want to say, when you start talking about that topic, it energizes me because it's so important, and because it's palpable, and it seems understandable. You know, public education seems like such a large nut to crack, so to speak, when you're thinking about how to transform the system. When you talk about the idea of third grade reading proficiency, it's something that people can understand. And my hope is that your hope is achieved in the broader population. I mean, it's clear amongst the education circles that everybody is moving in the direction of that beat, of that drum. But you said a couple of things, and we talked about this before as well, where the public discourse on this has not, it would be great to see this conversation not be an education-centered conversation, education circle, but people in the community are talking about getting kids on reading level by third grade. You know, that's the conversation in the barbershops, that's the conversation in the churches, that's the conversation in other houses of worship, where everybody is talking about that in a way where it's a public thing. And I think that that will help unlock some of the efforts that are clear to me from my time on this board, knowing that that's been a priority of several different administrations. And it continues to be elusive, because I think there's a gap with the partnerships with all that are involved in making that actually be a thing and have legs. And I hope that we can find a way to capture people's attention to it, because it's evident to me that there's a lot of momentum within the systems to do it. And we just need to energize people around it so that they can help be partners in that.
Yeah. Well, there's an expert in the room. You know, much more knowledge than me, and that's Dr. Szabo, who is now leading this work as a school administrator. So if there's anything you want to share with the group.
Yeah, so actually what came to mind, and I'm actually my school's test coordinator too, so I can speak to this.
You're going to be coming to the convening probably. Yeah.
So what I, like you said, I think there's a lot of reasons test scores have dropped. However, what I have a constant struggle with in my building is because they take so many different kinds of tests and so many tests throughout the year. Like in my district, we give mid-year or beginning year, mid-year, and end of year diagnostics in reading and math so that we can, you know, keep that pulse point and see how they're doing. Then now social studies has become a 3-year test. So they take that 3 times or 2 times throughout the year. They have a science test, they have Smarter Balance test. And as much as we try to stress to them as teachers, the Smarter Balance is like the Super Bowl. Like the rest of these were like practice or the game. This is the Super Bowl. It, to them, it's another test, and we're struggling. So I know the department puts out test security videos at middle or for secondary and elementary. Like if the department could help us get across to them, I mean, we've done assemblies, we've done, and they buy into it to a point, but at the end of the day to them, they all, I think it all kind of melts together, and it's just another test that I'm taking. Like we're struggling with how to stress to them, like this is how, this is the time to show us what you know. It's just hard. It's just hard.
Yeah.
And then there's also sometimes it's difficult when we're like, because last year they stressed to us at our test coordinator meetings like about excessive testing time, which again is very valid. But then we say things to them like, you have all the time you need to take this test. However, try to get it done in not an excessive amount of time. Like, so there's some mixed messages going out there too to kids that I think are difficult for them to get their brain around. But especially these little, I can't speak to elementary or high school, but my little hormonal teenagers, they don't see the difference between the iReady diagnostic and Smarter Balance. Like to them, in their brains, it's all the same thing. And they just are trying to get through it. So that's something I think the data is only good if it really is the student's best effort that we're looking at. And I've been doing this for 20 years. So I remember back at DSTP days when that was really the only data point we had from them at that point. And that created a lot of stress and anxiety for the kids because they felt like that was, they felt like it was a higher stakes test. But Smarter Balance is a high stakes test too. So we're struggling with finding that balance of them understanding the importance of it and the significance of it. So that's my two cents on that.
Well, I appreciate it. Something you mentioned in regard to the department's guidance last year, I think, or over the last few years about getting it done in one sitting. I think we're loosening that up and recognizing that that was a strategy we sort of tried and it might not have yielded the best result.
But it would work for every kid.
Yeah, there's no easy answer to any of it. If I had my druthers, the NAEP every 2 years would be the assessment that the entire country uses. That way we can compare truly.
We don't pay testing this year. Too. Right.
It's just NAEP every 2 years, fourth and eighth grade, high school, whatever measure you want to use. And of course, exam, SAT, pass it, AP, whatever. And if districts want to do other things, you know, in terms of formative assessments throughout the year, it makes sense. But I do think, you know, going back to No Child Left Behind, when we really started requiring testing every grade, every year, this is the result. And I think it does become the kids, you know, having you might. So, yeah, I think they just get worn down by it. But anyhow, thank you for the comments.
Particularly, though, with third grade, I think what concerns me most is, to me, that cohort would be the cohort that was greatest impacted by COVID. And so that disruption of learning was significant. Many times it's difficult making it up in class. And so, I mean, hearing from groups like Reading Assist that are really stressing high impact one-on-one tutoring, it would be interesting if there is data collection on the part of the state to look at those schools that are using that strategy to see what is the impact of that one-on-one tutoring. Because really, I think that's the only way at this point for that cohort that you're going to be able to improve their reading capabilities, because my guess is you have some students that are already sitting 2 years behind in terms of grade level reading.
You're 5 years old when COVID came around.
Yeah.
Do most of the tests take place in the morning or afternoons, or is it?
It depends.
I mean, I'm fresher in the morning. I'm going to tell you that right now. Afternoon, you could just, there's nothing left.
Yeah. Typically, we try to test them in the morning if we can, but it depends space-wise. Sometimes that's not.
You know, I even go as far as like Mondays and Fridays are shot.
Or like kids that don't have their Chromebook with them and have to use a loaner, and then we're at loaners, so we have to wait till a loaner's available. Yeah, it's a whole.
You don't use Scantrons anymore?
No, we don't use I miss DSTP. So we do try to test as many as we can in the morning, but it's not always feasible. And not every kid's better in the morning too. We just, as you know, a lot of adults tend to be, teachers especially tend to be morning people, but some of those kiddos don't hit their stride until like 11 a.m. in the morning. They're still waking up. So yeah, it just depends.
Okay, thank you.
My wife is a parent. My children are all teachers, but it's like a broken record. I hear the same thing from him, what I just heard from him. Thank you for being a teacher.
Well, actually, I'm an assistant principal as of 2 weeks ago. So, yeah, I don't want to identify as a teacher anymore. I defend them. Thank you. But yeah, thank you very much.
Mark, Secretary Hall, I got a question. The $60,000 salary. The local districts, will the state be doing most of it? Of course they do. How will the local districts make up?
Yes, it's a great question. So, you know, in Delaware, it varies by a few percentages depending on the district and contract that the local teachers union have negotiated. But the state pays about 70% of a salary, right? And so just for the sake of the conversation, I wish it were this high. Let's say it was $100,000 salary. State is paying about $70,000 of that. And then the local district is paying approximately the other 30. And some districts, because of their tax base, have a real hard time staying competitive on that 30% side. And that's where you get variations in compensation, you know, in salaries between districts. So a district like the one in which Sean and I worked in Del Mar, where he was a board member and I was principal, has a really, really hard time staying competitive with, let's say, a Newcastle County district that has a much stronger base, or even now a Cape Henlopen that has a, you know, a stronger tax base and can be, you know, more competitive. And in some districts, just levying a couple of cents can lead to a lot of money. Whereas again, in a district like Laurel, Woodbridge, Del Mar, you would really have to levy your taxes a good bit to be able to raise. Absolutely. You know. Now, with that said, it's a much smaller district, so the dollar goes further. But at the end of the day, we know there are a handful of districts that are I don't know whether it's through referendum, you know, or moving priorities around. I think it'll probably be a combination of things. I don't think the state the state pays 70%. It shouldn't become, for some districts, the state pays more, and instead what's called equalization should remedy this issue. But because equalization has not been addressed in over 20 years, it doesn't. And so that's where I think the fix is. Politically speaking, people are nervous, in part because, you know, county-wide taxes are being assessed right now, and they're going to be, you know, changed, and people don't know what that's going to look like exactly. So the timing of all of this is a little peculiar, but, you know, the good news is the getting to 60,000 is a 4-year plan. And so districts have some time to make adjustments.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
Could I comment on that, Sean, to piggyback on what you said? If we raise that minimum starting salary at 60, that means bringing everybody below that up to there or higher.
That is correct.
Yep.
That's a starting salary.
That's right, but there's a lot of teachers, I'm sure, that make a lot less than that right now.
That is correct.
So they're gonna bring them, you got to bring them, you can't leave them down there.
No, it will bring all of them up. Yeah, this isn't just for me. The way in which it's baked in through, you know, so this year, the recommendation, I should say, I mean, the governor will have to decide what he wants to recommend, and the General Assembly will have to decide what they support and what, you know, how they weigh in on this. But the committee actually recommended a percentage increase, Mr. Kenton, along with a set amount. It was somewhere in the neighborhood of, I want to say, $1,800. And that's because when you do percentages, people who are higher on the scale benefit even more, right? And so there's a way to sort of balance that.
They get a formula.
Yeah. And that's where the CFOs working with DOE, West Ed, and then the entire committee taking action. And, you know, DSEA was represented at the table on the committee and very, very supportive. I think the recommendations really do make good sound sense.
Sure. Just more follow up on that.
Yeah, sure.
Is there anything else for Secretary Holliday?
Just want to make a brief comment about equalization. There is likely going to be some substantive work product coming out of the equalization
committee,
which is
hired a consultant to actually do the work of looking at how the equalization formula can actually do equalization in actuality as opposed to what it is doing. So that's exciting, and I'm looking forward to being able to share more about that. Right now, the scope of work for the consultant is being defined about what we want them to do with respect to analyzing and coming back with recommendations for the formula. So that's a good sign. So,
yeah, that's good to hear.
It is. Thank you. If there's nothing else for Secretary Holodick, time has been set aside at the point in the agenda for general public comment. Ms. Smith, is there anyone signed up to provide public comment?
No, there is not.
Excellent. Thank you. Is there a motion to move to executive session?
So moved. Holly Rushdan.
Mr. Rushdan's made a motion. I need a second. Wait for a second. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Abstentions? The board will now enter to executive session.